Chapter 3, Fairfax High. I'll never forget my first day of high school. I arrived at Uni High and checked in with my counselor to get my class assignment. Then she dropped the bombshell. "Tony, I know you've been going to Emerson for 3 years under a false address. Because you don't live in the district, you can't go to school here." I didn't know it then, but that was one of the most eventful twists of fate I'd ever experienced. I went home to figure out what high school was in my district. It turned out to be Fairfax High, a sprawling school in the corner of Fairfax and Melrose. I went there the next day and felt like an alien in a sea of people who already knew one another. Because I was a day late, a lot of the classes I wanted were full. I didn't know any of the students, I didn't know any teachers, I didn't even know where the cafeteria was. I started filling out my class forms, and when they asked for my name, I impulsively wrote Anthony instead of Tony. When roll was called, the teachers all called out Anthony Kiedis, and I didn't correct them. I just became Anthony, this slightly different guy who was more mature, more in control, more adult. Fairfax was a true melting pot. There were Chinese immigrants, Korean immigrants, Russian immigrants, Jewish kids, and tons of black kids, along with the white kids. Once again, I started befriending all of the loneliest and the most unwanted kids in school. My first friends were Ben Tang, a scrawny, uncoordinated, huge, bespectacled Chinese kid, and Tony Schur, a pasty-faced 98-pound weakling. About a month into the school year, Tony and I were talking in the quad at lunchtime when a tiny, crazy-looking, gap-toothed, big-haired kid came waltzing up to Tony, put him in a headlock, and started roughing him up. I couldn't tell at first if this was friendly fooling around or if the guy was bullying my best friend at Fairfax, so I erred on the side of friendship. I stepped in, grabbed him off Tony, and hissed, "If you touch him again like that, you're going to regret it for the rest of your life." "What are you talking about? He's my friend," the kid protested. It's weird. Even though we were starting off on this "I'll kick your ass" aggressiveness, I felt an instant connection to the remarkable little weirdo. Tony told me his name was Michael Balzari, soon to be known beyond the confines of Fairfax High as Flea. Mike and I became inseparable. He lived about 5 blocks from me on Laurel Avenue. Every day we'd walk home from school, scrape together our meager assets, and buy a plate of taquitos to share at this hamburger taco grease shack. Then we'd play football on the street. In a strange way, I was going from this very adult life with my father, partying and nightclubbing and hanging out with primarily his friends, to having a second, genuine, no-worries childhood. Mike was another outsider at Fairfax. He had been born in Australia. His father was a customs agent who had moved his family to New York and enjoyed a pretty conservative, stable lifestyle until Mike's mom took up with a jazz musician. Mike's parents split up, and he and his sister and his mom and his new stepdad moved to L.A. Mike was painfully shy and insecure, and much more sheltered than I had been, so I assumed the alpha role in the relationship. This would be the dynamic that would continue for a long time, and it would be a beautiful thing, because we shared so much together. However, it would also carry an aspect of resentment for him, because I was kind of a bastard and a mean-spirited bully at times along the way. Mike would never go anywhere without his trumpet. He was first trumpet in the school band, which meant that we'd work together. I was in play production that year. I was impressed by his musical skill and the fact that his lip was always swollen from playing the trumpet. His trumpet playing also opened me up to a whole other world, the world of jazz. One day, Mike played me a Miles Davis record, and I realized that there was this type of music that was spontaneous and improvisational. Even though Mike was living in a more or less traditional family unit, his situation at home seemed as chaotic as mine. He would regale me with stories of his out-of-control stepfather, Walter. For years, Walter had dealt with an alcohol problem. He had gotten sober, a concept that I was unfamiliar with then, but now he was a real hermit. I hardly ever saw him, and the few times that I did, he'd be real gruff, screaming because Mike could not remember once to take out the trash on the right day. Every single time it was, oh, I forgot, it's Thursday. I'll be in so much trouble. Mike's mom was a real sweetheart, even if she had a bizarre Australian accent. But for the first few months I knew him, Mike kept talking to me about his older sister, Karen, who was back in Australia. "She's a wildcat," he'd tell me. "She's really hot. She's got a million boyfriends, and she's the best gymnast at Hollywood High. She went streaking in the middle of a citywide competition." I had to meet this Balzari sister. Later that school year, Karen finally showed up. She was young and foxy and incredibly forward. By then, it was common for Mike and me to sleep over at each other's houses. In fact, Mike's room had two tiny cot beds, one for him and one for me. His family had a hot tub in the backyard, and one night, Mike, Karen, and I were in the tub drinking some wine. Karen's hand was continually wandering over to me under those bubbles. And when Mike called it a night, and I was about to do the same, Karen grabbed me. "You stay," she implored.
Time to meet the sister.
Karen immediately took charge. She started making out with me, then took me back to her bedroom, where she spent the next 3 hours introducing me to a variety of sexual experiences I hadn't even known were possible. She was on her game, doing things like going to the sink and coming back with a mouthful of hot water and giving me a blowjob. What in heaven's name had I done to deserve this beautiful experience? The next day, Mike asked,
"How is my sister?"
I spared him the details because, after all, she was a sister, but I did thank him profusely for introducing us. Years and years later, he came to me and said,
"We're really good friends, but this is something that's been bothering me for years. While you were in the room with my sister, I went outside the house and was peeping through the window for a few seconds."
By then, I couldn't have cared less, but it was probably a good thing that he waited as long as he did to tell me. Mike was into pot when I first met him, so I began to dip more and more into my dad's stash to satisfy our needs. I knew the hiding places on the top of the bookshelves where he kept his half-smoked joints. But he locked his main stash in the same closet where he kept his scale. One day, I was hanging out with Mike in his stepdad's cellar workshop, and I came across a huge cache of skeleton keys. It was a one-in-a-million chance, but I asked Mike if I could try these keys on Blackie's closet, and sure enough, I found one that worked. So I started to carefully skim off my dad's stash of grass, quaaludes, and coke. Mike was impressed that I could grab a bud and leave everything so intact that Blackie never realized anything was missing. My first real bonding trip with Mike happened that semester, when we went skiing on Mammoth Mountain. The Greyhound bus ride up was full of your classic mixed nut variety of derelicts and forlorn people. Girl with a black eye, a speed freak who'd just been fired from his job, the whole bus culture of weirdos, and us two green kids. Immediately, I went to the back bathroom, smoked half a joint, then passed it to Mike, and he repeated the ritual. By the time we got to Mammoth, a blizzard had started, and it was pitch black. Our plan was to spend the night in the laundry room of the condos there, a tip that one of my Emerson friends had given me, but the Greyhound left us in the middle of nowhere. We set out in the general direction of the condos, and suddenly Mike got a horrible stomach ache. We walked and walked, and we were freezing, and Mike was nearly in tears from the pain. Just as frostbite was about to set in, we made an arbitrary turn and found the condos. We walked into the laundry room, got out our sleeping bags, and rolled out one beneath the rickety plywood shelf for folding clothes, and the other on top of the shelf. I popped a few quarters in the dryer and curled up on the floor, while Mike slept on the rickety shelf that was meant to hold a few pounds of clothes. The next morning, we went to rent skis. We picked out all our equipment, and Mike tried to pay with the credit card his mom had given us, but the 17-year-old girl behind the counter wouldn't take it. She insisted Mike's mom had to be there in person to authorize the charge. Mike tried to explain that his mom was already on the slopes, but she wouldn't budge. I had to salvage this trip, so I went outside and approached a lady who was getting ready to ski with her kids and asked to borrow her jacket and her ski hat and her glasses. Somehow, I convinced her, and I put on her parka and her hat and her big square sunglasses. I took our mittens and hats and stuffed them in the parka to make tits, and I channeled Mike's mom's voice in my head, and then I went back into the ski shop and marched up to the girl behind the counter. "I can't believe you pulled me off the slopes for this. This is my card, and I gave it to my son. What is your problem?" I said. The girl was scared out of her mind, hearing this crazy woman's voice coming from behind this ski mask, and we got the stuff. We had the time of our lives, getting stoned on the chairlift and cutting in line and being the little bastards that we were. Mike had no idea at all how to ski. The first time down the mountain, he fell about 50 times. By the third time, he was keeping up with me. He just willed himself to learn to ski within an hour. That night, we went back to the laundry room and quartered our way through another night. We got in a second day of skiing, and it was time to go home. For some reason, I decided that the ski shop really didn't have a good inventory system, so these skis were now ours. We walked to the Greyhound station and loaded the rentals onto the bus with everyone else's skis. We were just about to board when a sheriff's car pulled up. The sheriff got out and said, "You two, over here, now."
"What's the problem?"
I said innocently.
Those skis are stolen property. I need some ID, he said. Oh, no, we're not taking these. Did you think we were taking these skis? No, we rented these and we were actually going to bring them back. In fact, we could probably just leave them here and go now, I desperately riffed. We finally convinced the guy to just ticket us, and we promised to come back up and resolve the issue. We made it back down to Hollywood. The trip had been a monstrous success, even with a bad taste left in the mouth from the sheriff thing at the end. Some time passed, and no calls, no summonses, no bad news coming from up north. And then one day, it happened. Both Mike and I had been keeping an eye on the mail, but on the same day, while we were in school, both Blackie and Walter got letters. Now we were in serious trouble. Walter was strict, and my dad wasn't having any kind of extra inconvenience in his life, especially because minors had to bring their parents to court in Mammoth. Now these guys had to deal with our problem. We were thinking it was going to be the end of the world as we knew it, but oddly enough, both our dads used that trip as a bonding session with their sons. Ultimately, we got off with a slap on the wrist, and all we had to do was write a letter every couple of months for 6 months, telling them how we were doing. But my ski escapade with the authorities was minor compared to what would happen to Blackie that fall. It was the perfect fall California day, sunny and beautiful. I came home from school about 3:30 p.m., like any other day, but my dad seemed a little aggravated over something. We were in our living room, which had a nice picture window that looked out over our front yard, when Blackie froze in his tracks. I looked out and saw these Grizzly Adam-looking guys, big, burly lumberjack types, lurking in our front yard. My dad put his hand on my shoulder and said, "I think these guys might be undercover." As soon as that word came out of his mouth, the solid oak front door was kicked in. Simultaneously, the back door was flattened, and a phalanx of guys with shotguns and bulletproof vests and pistols poured in. Their shotguns were loaded and cocked and aimed right at my dad and me. They were all screaming, "Freeze! Freeze! Get on the floor!" like we were some huge operation. One false move of the finger, and we would have been full of lead. They handcuffed us to each other on the couch and set about the business of systematically destroying our house. It turned out that my dad had called a prostitute to come over a few nights earlier, but when she got there, she wasn't my dad's cup of tea. To be a good sport, he offered her some cocaine. She stormed out and called the cops and told them that Blackie might be the Hillside Strangler, who was terrorizing L.A. at that time. The cops spent the next 2 hours shredding mattresses and going through every article of clothing in the closet, and stealing all these nice switchblades that I bought in Tijuana so they could go home and give them to their kids. Thankfully, they weren't finding any drugs. Just when I was thinking that they might not discover my dad's treasure trove, one of the anal knuckleheads burrowed a hole up into the ceiling of the back closet and found everything. At that point, my father and I knew the jig was up. They took out the big rocks of coke, the bags of weed, and the huge Quaalude jar. They started deliberating what to do with me. They were talking about taking me to juvie, but I knew I had to stay out of jail so I could help Blackie get bail. I convinced them that I had nothing to do with any of this, and I needed to be in school in the morning. They finally agreed that I could stay in the ransacked apartment, and then they took Blackie away. We were both crushed. I had visions of my dad going away for years. So I called up Connie, and she got her new boyfriend to put up his house as collateral. The next day, Blackie was out of jail. He had saved up around $7,000, which he had to immediately put down for a good lawyer. This put even more of a strain on our finances, because he had really cut down on his dealing and was more into his acting. Luckily for us, a few months earlier, I had been cast in a Coca-Cola commercial, and that was pretty good bank for a 15-year-old kid. But it generated more friction with my dad, because I was making more money than he was. He even tried to get me to pay some rent, which became a bone of contention between us, as did the 20% he was already taking out of my acting income as my manager. All of this was creating a schism in the Kiedis partnership. Meanwhile, I was totally preoccupied with my budding social life at Fairfax. A few months after I met Mike, I met another person who would become one of the closest friends I'd ever have. Every so often, we'd have weird local high school rock bands that would play on the outdoor stage in the quad at Fairfax. Sometime that first semester, I saw a silly group called Anthem play. When I say silly, don't get me wrong. All these guys were really talented, but they were a little behind the times as far as I was concerned. They were doing covers of Queen and Led Zeppelin, all these bands whose times had come to an end, and they all had these big, poodly-looking, long, curly hairdos. At the gig, some people were passing out these homemade rectangular anthem buttons, so I took one. I was wearing the pin one day when I ran into one of the guitar players from Anthem. His name was Hillel Slovak. We started talking, and he invited me over to his house for a snack. Within a few minutes of hanging out with Hillel, I sensed that he was absolutely different from most of the people I'd spent time with. I usually felt like the leader in most relationships with kids my age, because of all the crazy experiences that I'd had as a kid. But I immediately knew that Hillel was at least my equal, and in fact knew a lot of things that I didn't. He understood a lot about music, and he was a great visual artist, and he had a sense of self and a calm about him that were just riveting. Hillel was Jewish. He looked Jewish and talked about Jewish stuff, and the food in that kitchen was Jewish. He made us egg salad sandwiches on rye bread that day, which was totally exotic food to me then. After the sandwiches, we had a meaningful heart-to-heart chat. By the time I left his house, I was thinking, well, that's my new best friend for life right there. It had been like that when I met Mike and Joe Walters. Sometimes you just know. Hillel had a Datsun B-10 station wagon, and we spent many, many nights driving up to the top of the Hollywood Hills, pulling into a rest stop, looking out over the city, putting in some crazy progressive rock tapes, smoking weed, and discussing the girls at Fairfax. It was one thing to meet Mike and Hillel, who would both become such important people in my life, but what are the odds that I'd meet three soulmates that first year at Fairfax? I had actually met Haya Handel before Mike or Hillel. During the first week of school, I was in Spanish class, and my eyes were riveted by this amazingly beautiful girl with long brown wavy hair, perfect pale skin, and big brown eyes that radiated with a mad twinkle. She was Jewish, and she was also by far the smartest person in the class, but she was amazingly down-to-earth and surprisingly flirtatious. Of course, I immediately developed a major crush on her. Whenever I saw her, I'd chat her up. But she soon made it known to me that she was not available as a girlfriend. At first, I thought she was seeing this blonde guy named Johnny Carson, who would later play a major role in my life. But she told me that he was just her old friend from junior high. It turned out that she was going out with a guy named Kevin, a tall, strapping, handsome black kid who was the star of the gymnastics team. I knew Haya was from a conservative Jewish family, and they felt it would be taboo for her to date anybody but a Jew. So her relationship with the black gymnast was a big secret from her family. We'd talk, and she'd confide in me. I really want to go out with my boyfriend, but I can't. It's too risky, and my parents might find out. It was all tragic information, because it wasn't me. But I definitely didn't lose interest and move on. We sat side by side in another class that semester. It was right after lunch, so I'd always see her boyfriend walk her to class, where they'd do their little goodbyes. One day, I just decided, fuck it, I'm bringing flowers. I bought a bouquet and wrote a poem. But by the time I got back to school, class had already started. I rushed into the classroom, and the teacher said, "Is there a good reason why you're late?" "Well, not really," I said, and handed Haya the flowers and the poem. Everyone oohed and awed, and the teacher instantly cut me some slack. Haya was embarrassed, but she realized that this guy must be pretty crazy about her. That signaled the beginning of my getting in with her, but it was a rocky beginning that would stretch out into the next year at school. By the second half of 10th grade, I had somehow burned through all the money I had saved for my acting career, which was mostly dormant since I just wanted to concentrate on being a regular high school kid. Since Blackie's cash flow was so meager, I got a part-time job as a delivery boy for an upscale liquor store called John and Pete's. I loved that job. I'd drive recklessly, breaking all the laws, speeding and going on the wrong side of the street, and cutting around traffic to make my deliveries so I could take my time getting back to the store. After a few weeks, I realized that if I hid a bottle of booze or a six-pack in the store trash, I could go back to the dumpster later, retrieve it, and be good for the night. Combined with the 30 bucks in tips I'd pull in a shift, if I worked a few days a week, I'd have my spending money. But my first year at Fairfax was mostly an oasis from responsibility. I had all of this beautiful free time to roam and play and walk aimlessly and discover, to talk and get into mischief and steal and vandalize and go visit some friend and try to find some pot to smoke and maybe play some basketball. There was really no pressure, no anxiety. Might have homework, but I did it after dinner. Mike was my constant companion. On those long walks, we'd pass all of these 1, 2, 3, and sometimes 4- and 5-story apartment buildings that were built around a central pool. One day, an amazing idea was triggered. I looked at the building and said, That's a diving board, my friend. I had gotten some experience in Michigan with jumping off of railroad trestles into bodies of water. Sometimes we would wait until right before the train came, and it was an amazing rush. Mike was game for anything, so he started out by jumping off second-story buildings into the pools. It didn't matter if people were sitting around the pool sunbathing. That made it all the more fun, to be the guy who flew out of the sky and landed next to an unsuspecting sunbather. If there was any chance of getting caught, we'd make the jump and then take off like bats out of hell and cut through some backyards and get away. But there were other times when we'd come out of the water and recognize that we weren't in any danger of getting busted. So it was yet another opportunity to freak somebody out by yelling or dancing around or mooning. We finally worked our way up to 5-story buildings. Our favorite was on King's Road. We'd get up on the roof and look down and see a postage stamp of water, and we would go for it. Then I started experimenting with different styles of jumping. I wasn't about to dive into a pool, but I started jumping off the building backward, doing Superman things. I would run out, and instead of jumping far ahead, I'd jump straight up and go into an arch and lie down and then go back straight into the pool. It didn't matter how deep the pools were. You didn't need much water to land in. If it's a shallow pool, as you hit the water, you let your body go sideways, so you're using the width of the water as well as the depth. My dad knew about the jumping, and he wasn't a fan. He didn't try to put a stop to it, but he'd lecture me from time to time. "Don't you go jumping. I know you're smoking pot all the time. It's not a good combination." At that point, we didn't communicate about a lot of things. He'd complain, and I'd ignore him and say, "Whatever. Fuck you." One day in June of that year, Mike and I had been eyeing this apartment building just down the block from my house. The pool was small and teardrop-shaped, and the deep end was the smallest section of the teardrop. To get to the top of the building, we had to climb over railings, and we made enough of a commotion climbing up that somebody started yelling at us to get down. We never even thought of aborting. I told Mike to go, and he jumped, and I heard the splash. Then I got up on the railing. I didn't even look down to see my angle. I was more concerned with the people who were yelling. I jumped, and as I was in the air, I realized that I'd put too much into the leap, and I was going to overshoot the pool. But there was nothing I could do about it. The concrete was coming up at me, and I landed smack on my heels and missed the pool by about 10 inches. I was dazed and fell back into the pool and started to sink. Somehow, despite being in paralytic shock, I managed to push myself out of the pool, roll over onto the lip of the concrete, and emit this inhuman sound that sounded like it came from the depths of Hades. I looked over and saw Mike, but I couldn't move. Somebody called an ambulance, and the paramedics clumsily rolled me onto a gurney, almost dropping me in the process. They didn't stabilize the stretcher in the back of the ambulance, so I was bumping around in agony the whole ride to the hospital. It was pain, shock, and horror, and I knew something was seriously wrong because I still couldn't move. They took me to Cedars-Sinai and did an x-ray, and after a while, the doctor came into the room and said, "You broke your back, and it doesn't look so good." I had been keeping a pretty optimistic, stiff upper lip outlook on the whole thing, but when he gave me the prognosis, I started weeping. There goes my summer. There goes my athleticism. There goes my life. I started hitting on every nurse who came by, desperate for painkillers, but they wouldn't give me anything until the doctor had okayed it. Then Blackie came rushing in, screaming, "What did I tell you? Now who's right? Did I not tell you this would happen? You smoke pot, you jump off the thing, this was bound to happen." I just looked at the nurse and said, "Somebody take him away from here. He's not allowed in here." At last they got me medicated and rigged up a pulley system with a harness and a medical bustier girdle. I was told that my vertebrae were flattened like pancakes and that a month in traction would help stretch them back. During the first week in the hospital, I got visits from Mike and Hillel and a few other friends. By now, I had won Haya over, and she was kind of my girlfriend. Once she came to visit and lay down on the bed with me and let me feel her up, which was a real treat. Okay, broke the back, but at least I've got my hands on the breasts of the girl I've been in love with since the first day of Spanish class. After 2 weeks of traction, I started getting stir-crazy. One day, Hillel came to visit, and I told him, "I can't stay here for a day longer. You have to get me out of here." He went downstairs to get the car ready, and I unstrapped the girdle, rolled over, and tilted myself up on my 2 feeble legs. With my bare ass flashing out of my hospital gown, I started lurching like Frankenstein down that hallway. All the nurses went crazy, screaming that I couldn't go anywhere for 2 more weeks, but I didn't care.
Somehow, I made it down the steps, and Hillel helped me into the car. Before I went home, I made him drive me to the building where I had messed up so I could try to figure out what I'd done wrong. I spent the next few weeks horizontal in my own bed. I got some lovely visitations from a friend of my father's named Lark, who was a beautiful, relatively successful 20-something actress. She came by at all hours, during the day, late at night, whenever, just to fix me up sexually. I had gotten my girdle back, and I had to keep telling her to be real careful, but I was getting absolutely ridden by a wild, nymphomaniac banshee. That made the convalescing time a little more pleasant. That summer, I went back to Michigan, but I was still struggling with my back. Every time I'd get an x-ray, the doctors always said it didn't look good. It was crooked. The vertebrae were still smushed. It was never good news. But over time, my back progressively got better. At some point, Mike took a greyhound out to visit me. He showed up at my house after this torturous journey, looking totally haggard and sleep-deprived, since he had been squeezed the whole way between a giant, snoring Indian and someone who kept constantly throwing up. He had a penthouse with him, and I remember opening it up and all the pages were stuck together. That was the way it was when I got it, he lied. But he was as happy as a bunny rabbit once we got settled in. My mom treated him like her own son, and Steve let us take his car and explore Michigan. We took a camping trip to the Upper Peninsula. We visited my aunt and my cousins, and we went water skiing. We were two kids, grown up in some ways, but children in other ways. But certainly not thinking of ourselves as children. Thinking of ourselves as masters of the universe over all other life forms, including adults. We were hipper, cooler, smarter. We knew more about pretty much everything there was to know more about, and we were fine with that. Adolescence is such a fun time in your life, because you think you know it all, and you haven't gotten to the point where you realize you know almost nothing. So we had our summer fun. And when Mike was ready to go back, I remember my mom going to town with bags and bags of food for this poor kid who had to go on the Greyhound. She baked him a pecan pie and gave him a huge industrial-sized bag of Pepperidge Farm goldfish and treated him like a little prince. I went back for my second year at Fairfax, but things were getting increasingly troubled at home. After the bust, while my dad was waiting to be sentenced, he became a lot more careful. He stopped selling drugs completely and became the prototypical starving actor. We'd fight over the most mundane things. One time, he was outraged that I ate a can of his soup. Another time, I infuriated him when I ate a sandwich out of the refrigerator that he had been coveting all day. Around this time, Blackie also tried to impose a curfew on me. He arbitrarily decided that I had to be in by midnight. If I broke curfew, I'd be locked out. One night, I went out skateboarding and got home a few minutes after midnight, and the door was locked. I knocked, and I knocked, and knocked. There was no answer. Finally, he came to the door, totally incensed. What did I tell you? There's no getting in here after 12. He complained that he had to get up early to go to acting classes, and I was interrupting his sleep. This from the same guy who kept me up till 6 in the morning throughout my junior high years. The next time it happened, my neighbor came out and offered to let me crash on his couch, but I declined. I had tried to leave my window open a crack so I could sneak back in, but my dad was so security conscious that he'd make sure the house was airtight before he went to bed. So I had to wake Blackie again, and he was even madder this time. We had a shoving match in the kitchen, and he told me that I had to either follow his rules or get out. It was a no-brainer. I called Donde Bastone, this friend of mine, and asked if he wanted a roommate. I had met Donde during my first year at Fairfax, but by the 11th grade, he had dropped out and was dealing weed out of his own house on Wilcox. He was the only 16-year-old I knew who had it together enough to have his own pad and a great little car. He agreed to let me move in, but he laid out exactly how much rent I had to pay and what my responsibilities would be around the house. In the middle of the day, Haya came over in her huge car, and we started loading my stuff. It consisted of some clothes, my stereo, and a large neon shamrock billiard sign that my dad had given me. Unfortunately, as I was pulling out of the driveway, Blackie came home.
Whoa, where do you think you're going? He said.
I'm out. I'm leaving. You're seeing the end of me.
What's all this stuff in the car?
He asked. That's my stuff, I maintained.
It's not your stuff. It's my stuff.
You gave me this stuff, I reminded him.
I gave it to you as long as you're living under my roof. If you're not in the house, it's not your stuff.
We had this big argument over the belongings, which I lost, but I didn't even care at that point. I just wanted out. I moved in with Donde and immediately concluded that he was way ahead of his time in many different ways. For one, he had an extraordinary record collection, complete with special shelving units built to house it, and a really nice sound system. Part of his deal, along with being a knucklehead and smoking pot, was to play music all day and all night. Every waking hour in that house, there was a record spinning. Thankfully, he had incredible taste in music. He wasn't one of those guys who was exclusively into ska or punk rock or vintage blues. He was into everything. And because he had friends who worked at record companies, he was always getting advanced copies of albums by David Bowie or Talking Heads. Our house also became the party house, and we'd throw these rather gala affairs every couple of weekends. It was one of those periods when the drugs and alcohol were working to perfection and not interfering with getting work done, and no one was strung out on anything. Donde always seemed to come up with some cocaine for these parties, and cocaine then was a treat, not something that we had all the time, so we weren't carried away with it. Around this time, my relationship with Hillel intensified. I was taking a health class that was two doors down from Hillel's art class. His art teacher was very liberal, so I'd get passes from my health class to go to the bathroom, and I'd go and have some intense conversations while Hillel was doing his anatomical drawings. Mike and Hillel were also becoming friends and developing an interesting musical bond. Anthem was about to play a series of shows at other high schools, and out of nowhere, Hillel began to secretly teach Mike how to play the bass guitar. Todd, the current bass player in Anthem, wasn't a very good musician, though he did provide the band's PA system. But Hillel and Alan Michulski, the other guitarist, and Jack Irons, the drummer, were authentic musical talents, so Hillel was looking to replicate that on the bass. When Todd walked in on a rehearsal one day and saw little Mike playing Anthem songs on Todd's bass through Todd's bass amp, he took his equipment and quit the band. So Mike was in. Right before they started playing around, I approached Hillel and asked if I could introduce the band. Actually, I got the idea from Blackie, who had long been introducing his friends' bands with comic, ironic, Vegas-type speeches. Hillel agreed, and for my first introduction, I reworked one of Blackie's classic vamps. I used Cal Worthington, who had become famous in L.A. for his tacky late-night used auto ads. "Ladies and gentlemen, Cal Worthington calls them the hottest rockers in L.A. Their parents call them crazy, and the girls call them all the time. But I call them like I see them, and I call them Anthem," I screamed. Then I flew off the stage into the audience and danced for the entire show. It didn't matter one bit if I was the only person dancing. I was so into supporting my friend's art. But as much as I was a fan of the whole band, it really became about me and Mike and Hillel. Hillel had known Jack and Alan much longer, but when he found us, he felt that we were his guys. For one, Hillel was really into weed, and those other guys weren't. We were into insanity and pushing the envelope, and Alan and Jack were much more mama's boys. So me and Mike and Hillel became the real three musketeers for the next 2 years in high school. For our own amusement, we created alternate identities. Three Mexicans who spoke in stylized Cheech and Chong accents. I was Fuerte, strong. Mike was Paco, small. And Hillel was Flaco, slender. Together, we were Los Faces. We were a gang, but not a ruffian gang. We were a comedy gang. We spent hours and hours playing these characters, and it helped us develop a sense of camaraderie that would last for years. Meanwhile, my friendship with Haya was progressing, but not as smoothly as my bond with Mike and Hillel. We still had one major problem. I wasn't the nice Jewish boy her family had envisioned. I'll never forget the way she explained the situation to me. "This is how it is. I love you, you're my man, but my parents can never know because they don't want me to date someone who isn't Jewish. So as far as they're concerned, you and I are best friends and we work on school stuff together and that's it. Don't be affectionate toward me when you come over. Just act like my friend." It was hard. Her father barely spoke a word to me. Her mother was more cordial, but they both smelled something uncomfortable in their lives. And it was me. I could always see how their repression manifested itself in her psyche. As much as she tried not to limit herself to her parents' confined world, they still exerted a strong hold on her, a bond that she'd fight against. But when push came to shove, she'd never break it. She was their daughter. I knew she loved me, but she was afraid to go too far with that love. During 11th grade, I was crazy about the idea of making love to her. I'd had all of these different sexual experiences, but never one based in true love. I knew how much fun fucking could be, but here was a chance to do it for real. I was trying to get her to sleep with me, but she wouldn't commit. "No, give me time. I'm not ready. There's a birth control issue." She kept putting it off, and it became this ongoing, "Are you ready yet?" In the meantime, she'd give me hand jobs, which she was great at, but I wanted this girl in my arms while I was inside her. It was maddening. She was my world. I adored her. I would have done anything for her, but she wasn't giving it up. 7 months into the relationship, we went on a date, and I was wearing my best clothes, and I'd done my hair the best I could. We went back to my room with no intention of anything happening and started to kiss. We took off our clothes, and we were basically in a sphere of love and light and warmth, and the rest of the world disappeared. It was better than I ever could have dreamed. It was that thing I had been looking for, that love mixed with the rapture of sex. Once Haya and I started having a regular sexual relationship, I couldn't have been happier. I wanted to have sex with her all day and all night, every day and every night. If I didn't see her for a while, all I could think about was being with her. When I'd go on a trip to Michigan, I couldn't wait to see her again. Every song I listened to was about her. We had our special songs, David Bowie's Heroes and the Beatles' Here, There, and Everywhere. My senior year at Fairfax was rife with contradictions. Me and my friends were definitely outsiders, living by our own moral code, one tenet of which was, "Thou shalt steal your meals." Mike and I refined a method of food thievery that was unbeatable for about 2 years, until the supermarkets finally caught on to it. I would go into the market and fill up a little red plastic basket with the finest provisions they offered. Filet mignon, lobsters, cognac, you name it. Then I'd take my basket over to the magazine rack, which was directly adjacent to the entrance. I'd pick up a magazine and set my basket on the floor, and while I was perusing the magazine, I'd surreptitiously slide the basket under the chrome railing. Then Mike, who had been waiting outside, would dash in, grab the basket, and go right out the exit door. Soon we had an 8-foot-tall stack of empty red baskets behind my house, a testament to our continuing ability to feed ourselves in style. We still used our old tried-and-true bottle-up-the-pants method to steal booze. Once I even upped the ante and stole a pair of skis. I went to the back of the sporting goods store and asked, "What's the best pair of skis you have in here in my size?" The salesman said, "Well, these racing skis." I waited for him to leave, and I picked up the skis and walked right out the front door. I had decided that if I walked boldly right past the cashier, they would think, "He's picking up something that he's already paid for, because he's not stopping." In some respects, our antisocial impulses were getting reinforced by the music that we were listening to. When I first started Fairfax in 1977, punk rock had just begun to make itself felt in Los Angeles, but it was a tiny subculture. Blackie, to his credit, was on the cutting edge of the new music scene. He was one of the first people to frequent a punk rock club called The Mask, which was on Hollywood Boulevard. Whenever punk rock groups from New York would come to town, they'd play the Whiskey, and Blackie and I would always wind up at the Tropicana Motel, a seedy old classic paradise on Santa Monica Boulevard, which was where the band stayed and where the after-parties were. At that time, my favorite record was Blondie's First. Every one of those songs was indelibly etched on my soul, and I was totally in love with Deborah Harry. So when Blondie came to town, we headed to the Tropicana for the party. They had a suite, and Debbie was in the front room. We started talking, and I was smitten, totally melting. In my delusional state, I thought, "This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You might never see this woman again. You better make your move." With complete earnestness, I said, "I know I haven't known you that long, but will you marry me?" She smiled and said, "That's so kind of you to ask. I think you're a great guy, but I don't know if you know this, that guitar player I was playing with tonight, who's back there in the bedroom, well, that's my husband. We're very happily married, and I really don't have any room in my life for another man." I was crushed. Mike and I began hanging out in the punk scene by necessity. Shortly after we started Fairfax, I had brought Mike to the Rainbow one night. Before we got there, we drank a lot of Michelob beer. I had a tolerance for alcohol, but apparently he didn't. We were sitting at Blackie's power table, and the girls were there, and the music was going, and Mike looked at me and said, I'm not feeling so good. He started to rush outside, but before he could go 2 feet, he began projectile vomiting all over the rainbow. Not what they wanted from 2 underage kids in their establishment. He threw up all the way into the parking lot, where they gave him the boot. Then they came in for me and said, "Get out there with him. You're never coming back here again." I kept trying to get back in for a year, but they had really 86'd me. It was time to find my own scene. My first punk concert was a daytime show at the Palladium. Devo was playing, along with the Germs. I was standing in the back, just fascinated. The music was cool as shit. These people looked incredible, almost too cool for me. There was no way I could ever be accepted by this crowd, because they were light years ahead of me in terms of style. I remember walking over to the side of the stage, where people were going in and out of the backstage area, and there was this girl with some fucked up punk rock haircut, and she was taking giant safety pins and piercing her cheek with them, one after the other. That was new to me. Mike and I began trying to worm our way into this new scene, where, unlike at the Rainbow, I had no clout. There was an explosion of amazing bands in L.A. at the time. X and the Circle Jerks and Black Flag and China White. The list could go on and on. The energy was unbridled, more creative and exciting and bombastic than anything anybody had ever seen. Fashion-wise, energy-wise, dance-wise, music-wise, it was like the dawning of the Renaissance in my own town. Rock had become this boring old beast, ready to die. And now there was fresh, crazy-ass blood flowing through the streets of Hollywood. The first wave of punk rock had already crested, but there was a second coming. It wasn't a violent hardcore scene like the bands from Orange County. In Hollywood, it was more about creativity and originality. The Screamers and the Weirdos were 2 of Hollywood's first punk rock bands, but they sounded nothing alike. What all these bands did share was an element of anarchy and nonconformity. That first X record, or all of the Black Flag records from that time, were masterpieces. Darby Crash's lyrics for the Germs were as good as it ever got in the world of punk rock. He was on to a whole other level of intelligence. So Mike and I hung out in the parking lot of the Starwood, probably the best punk rock venue around then, and we started to poke our noses through the door of this world. The Starwood was a tough club to sneak into, but there was a side door near the parking lot guarded by a huge bouncer. If a fight broke out and his attention got diverted, we'd slip in as fast as we could. Sometimes, if a bunch of people were going in, we tried the crawling thing and used them as cover. When we couldn't sneak into the show, we'd linger in the parking lot. But neither of us had a lot of mojo or game, so we'd have to watch the goings-on. Nobody was inviting us to hang out. One time, Mike and I sneaked into the Starwood for a Black Flag show. We were fish out of water. We loved these bands, but we dressed all wrong, and we had the wrong haircuts and the wrong shoes, and we didn't even dance like all the punks. Those guys had the really cool boots with the chains wrapped around them and the right combination of ripped-up plaid clothes and spiked haircuts. Mike and I were lucky to have one leather jacket between the two of us. Black Flag put on an amazing show. They had a guy on stage called Mugger, who was in charge of security. Every time someone tried to jump up on stage and dance around a bit and then jump back off, Mugger would just attack the person and get into a brutal fist fight. During all this, the band did not miss a beat. One guy managed to get past Mugger and stage dive. He flew right by me, and I got kicked in the head with his heavy steel-toed boot. I almost passed out. One of the reasons we didn't plunge feet first into this scene was that in some ways, we were still model students at Fairfax. At least I was. It was a strange dichotomy. I smoked tons of pot, took pills, and drank on the weekends. But it never got out of control. I never missed school. It was important to me to be the straight-A student. In a way, I was a rebel by getting good grades, because most of the stoners and the druggies were getting no grades. I didn't want to be like them. When I was a junior, I got my report card, and it was A's all the way down the line, which I loved. I wanted to be the best at whatever it was that was in front of me. On my terms. I didn't necessarily want to study for hours to get there, but I wanted to do enough at the last minute. By this time, we were all thinking about college. At the end of my senior year, my grades were starting to slip, and I had to go to Mrs. Lopez, my Spanish teacher, and beg, borrow, and steal to get a B. Mike was having his own problems with grades. He always vacillated between being an absolutely brilliant student and an absolute flunkout. Our last semester, he was in Don Platt's Honors History class with Haya. Platt was a no-nonsense general who was in total command of his class. He was bald but in great physical shape, with a perfect tan, a suave Gavin McLeod type. Mike and I had been running around like maniacs the week before his big final, and he didn't study for it, so he cheated. The last guy on planet Earth you'd want to get busted by for cheating was Don Platt. He was not afraid to call you out in front of the class and humiliate you. That's what he did to Mike, who came out of class that day white as a ghost. Getting a D in Platt's class would put a pretty major dent in Mike's chances for getting a good grade point average. But it wasn't my worry. I was already a shoo-in to college with my grades. In fact, I planned to go to Don Platt for one of my recommendations so I could go to UCLA. I had been Platt's student for 3 years, and I had aced every one of his classes, so I knew he'd give me the crown jewel of all recommendations. A few days later, I went to see him after school, and he had a very unwelcoming look on his face. I asked him for a recommendation, and it was as if he already had a speech prepared. "Anyone who associates with Michael Balzeri is not a friend of mine, nor is he getting a recommendation from me. For all I know, you and Michael were cheating the whole time you were in my classes." This was absurd. I was probably the best student he'd had in 10 years. The only time I'd even come close to crossing him was in my first semester. I had chosen to do an oral report on Uriah P. Levy, who was a great American naval officer. During the course of my research, I discovered the derivation of the word fuck. It came from the early naval logs that the captain would keep. If a crew member was punished for having sexual intercourse, it was noted in the log as fuck, for unlawful carnal knowledge. That was too good a factoid not to share with the class. So I was up there spieling on Uriah P. Levy and the Navy, and it was all Monty Python-esque to me. I got to the punishable offenses, and I walked up to the chalkboard and wrote F-U-C-K in huge letters. I looked over at Mr. Platt, and the blood was rushing to the top of his bald head, but I never cracked a smile and continued to explain the concept. Meanwhile, Mike and the rest of the class came unglued, but there was nothing Platt could do. I had him. Now he thought he had me. I tried to make my case for the recommendation, but he wasn't having any of it. "There's the door," he said. I walked out of there shell-shocked. Ultimately, I wound up going to the geometry teacher, and he was nice enough to write me a great recommendation. But I still had to get even with Platt. Somewhere along the line that semester, I had stumbled upon some cardboard boxes of beautiful, big black and red plastic marquee letters. Thinking they might be useful for an art project, I kept them. At the end of that Memorial Day weekend, the night before we were supposed to return to classes, Mike and I were driving around, stoned on pot, listening to music, when a brilliant idea came to me. We drove up to the marquee in front of Fairfax High and started climbing up the pole, armed with the appropriate letters. Then we spelled out, "Dandy Don Platt sucks anus," and motor oiled the pole and the platform to inhibit the progress of anyone who would try to take our message down. We looked up at the sign, congratulated each other, and went home and fell asleep. The next day we went to school, and there was a whole hubbub of activity around the marquee, people taking pictures and workmen trying to circumvent the motor oil and get those letters off. Nobody ever came to Mike or me for questioning. We weren't even suspects. Maybe Platt had screwed over enough kids that there was an abundance of people with a motive. But that wasn't the end of it. At the end of that summer, we decided to leave a message for the incoming class at Fairfax. So we went back to the box of letters, climbed back up that pole, and left, "Dandy Don continues to suck anus."